Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm really excited about today's show. Mary Mattingly will be joining us. She is a New York resident artist who is doing some really great work, and I will tell you about it in just a little bit when she comes on. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the news, some events you want to participate in. Of course, I know you all want to get out and vote. And, of course, I want to share my weekly recipe for you. So first, in a week and a half is Election Day, and I am assuming everybody has already registered to vote, because if you haven't, you've missed the boat. But voting is a week from Tuesday, and it's a real big deal. It's a real big deal. With the current administration we have, we really need to focus on local elections and our local politicians and really change things around on the local level until we can make big changes in Washington. Although we do have the opportunity to turn the House and the Senate if possible. So please, please get out and vote and get everybody you know out there to vote, because we need to make some changes with the current report on our climate. It has everybody who's concerned about the climate concerned, and yet you still have these bozos in Washington saying that it doesn't matter. So we really need to turn that around. So please, please get out and vote a week from Tuesday. I am still working on the Long Island Food Conference, which is coming up next weekend on Saturday, November 3rd. We've added a pre-conference film screening of the film What the Health, and that will screen on Friday evening, November 2nd. It will be a free screening, and this is a great film talking about our food system and the foods that we should be eating and why it is in the pharmaceutical companies and our healthcare system not to promote good food. It's really in their best interest to keep us sick, because they make a lot of money when we're sick. But we don't want to give them that money. We'd rather keep that money in our own pockets. So we want to stay healthy, and the way to do that is to eat real food. And no matter what your diet is, I mean, there's, you know, What the Health certainly takes the angle and philosophy of a plant-based diet. But I know from having been in the food arena for so long that everyone has to find the diet that works well for them. But the commonality for all of the diets, whether you are going paleo or you're doing bone broth or you're doing raw or you're doing vegan, plant-based, whatever it is, use real food. Start with real food. Start with good quality food and purchase it from those people that are taking care of our earth, taking care of the planet, raising whatever it is you're buying in a responsible, sustainable way. And I'm sure we'll be talking more about that when the artist Mary Mattingly comes on, because so much of her work is focused on sustainability and on keeping the environment healthy. So this food conference is just going to be great. Like I said, after the screening on November 2nd, the conference is all day on Saturday, November 3rd. Frances Moore Lappe is our keynote speaker, and she is the author of Diet for a Small Planet and co-founder of the Small Planet Institute. And her work is just amazing. She was way ahead of her time. She really promotes a food system that is fair and equitable for everybody. Food justice cannot be separated from our food system, because if you look at the food that's available in so many different neighborhoods, it is not just, it is not fair, and it is not healthy. So we really need to look at our food system from so many different angles. We will have four panels throughout the day after the keynote speaker. One is on food policy and how food policy affects the food that we have access to, and what we can do to change some of that food policy, one of which, of course, is getting out and voting. And then we have another panel on food and climate change and how food impacts our climate change. People don't think that they're connected, but they are very much connected. Then we will break for a delicious, mostly plant-based lunch that is being prepared to us from LIU's food service, but they have a sustainability program where they are sourcing everything within a 250-mile radius, and so that should be a really great lunch. Then in the afternoon, we have two more panels. The first one is Food is Medicine, and we are going to have Dr. Robert Graham from Fresh Med joining us. He is a doctor who is also trained at the Natural Gourmet Institute about healthy cooking, and he has recognized that most doctors have no clue what healthy food is, or let alone how to cook it. So his goal has been to really teach doctors how to eat well and how to cook healthy food so that they can share that knowledge with their patients. Then we also will have the natural nurse, Ellen Kamai, who actually is one of the hosts of a radio show on this Progressive Radio Network. Ellen has a wealth of knowledge about everything herbal and botanical. She is just amazing. So she will be joining us talking about foraging, things that you can just find out in the wild that you can eat and help keep yourself healthy. And then Sally Fallon Morrell will be joining us. She's the founder of the Weston Price Foundation, big promoter of bone broth, and she will be sharing with us her knowledge about raw dairy and bone broth versus pasteurized, homogenized stuff that we call milk and dairy that we find in our supermarkets. So that will be the Food is Medicine. And our last panel is on growing food, and we have four different representations of how you grow food. One is Fred Lee from Sang Lee Farms. They have a large CSA operation, so it's a commercial CSA program where they are growing lots of organic, delicious, beautiful, beautiful food. Then we will have Michael Dahl from Montauk Shellfish Company. He's been working. He's a research scientist at Southampton Research Center from Stony Brook University. And he will be talking about growing seaweeds and oysters and vertical farming in the ocean and how you can grow seafood that way and at the same time cleaning up the water. Fran Wilsell will be there from Gateway Community Garden. She'll be talking about community gardens as a way to enable people to grow their own food. And then Stefan Oberman from Aero Farms will be talking about the huge hydroponic farm that they have in Newark, New Jersey, and how that is a replicable operation that they're hoping to take nationwide everywhere and grow food close to the cities where people need to get it. So it's going to be a full day. We'll finish up with a wine and cheese reception with a live band, a reggae jazz band. And tickets are priced so that everyone can afford it. So we do hope you come. Another event that I want to share with you is this year is my 24th annual Cooking Thanksgiving Feast for the Needy. And every year I cook Thanksgiving and Christmas meal for people in need in Jamaica, Queens. And we partner with the River Fund New York Food Pantry, which is the largest food pantry in New York City, or servicing more families than any other food pantry. And they are unique because they actually recognize that the path out of poverty is education. And they do a lot to help enable the young people within the system to go on to higher education and make it possible with loans and grants, etc. So they're doing great work. So if you want to sign up on my website at IE Green, there are sign-ups so that you can participate in the Thanksgiving Feast for the Needy. And now I want to share with you my recipe. Plus, I want to just let you know that all these events that I talk about from week to week, and there's so many more. I know Just Food is having their gala coming up. The Coalition for Healthy School Food is having their gala coming up. There's so many different events coming up that you do want to check my website at ieatgreen.com under events and find an event near you. And if you have an event you'd like me to share on my website or with my listeners, please just email that to me at bhavani@iegreen.com. So this week's recipe is a tempeh puttanesca with fire-roasted tomatoes, mushrooms, capers, and olives. And this will serve four people. And I started with two 8-ounce packages of tempeh. And I cut the tempeh in half across the middle the short way, and then I cut it in half the long way so that I have four rectangle pieces. And then I take each piece and I cut that horizontally so that I'm making each of the rectangles thinner. So from each package of tempeh, I end up with eight pieces. And actually, this would feed probably more like six people. I miscalculated. And then I used one organic onion, cut in half, and then sliced into crescent moons, 1 pound of organic baby portobello mushrooms sliced, 1 can of organic fire-roasted tomatoes, 2 cups of assorted fresh cherry tomatoes, 1/4 cup of small capers, 1/4 teaspoon red chili flakes, and that's optional. If you don't like things spicy, you can leave that out. And this is not too spicy. If you like it really spicy, put in 1/2 teaspoon. 1 cup of organic Kalamata olives, sliced in half. 2 tablespoons chopped garlic. 1/4 cup chopped Italian parsley, stems removed. And fresh herbs. I had in the garden still growing oregano, sage, rosemary, thyme, and basil, and I used it all. And then 1/4 cup of white wine, salt and pepper to taste, and some olive oil for sautéing. And so I started by covering the bottom of a wok with the olive oil. And when the oil was hot, I added the onions and cooked those for a few minutes until they became translucent. Then I added the garlic and the mushrooms and cooked that down. When you first start cooking, mushrooms, a lot of liquid comes out of it. You want to just cook it down until the water gets absorbed so there's no more liquid in there. While that is sautéing, I steamed the tempeh. When you steam the tempeh before you put it in the oven and cook it, or before you marinate it with any sauce, steaming it opens up the pores of the tempeh and allows the flavor to be absorbed, and also assures that the tempeh is going to be cooked all the way through. So steaming it is really great. So I set up a steamer and I steamed that for just about 10 minutes. Then I transferred the tempeh to a baking sheet that I lined with some parchment paper and sprayed it with a little oil. And I baked that for 10 minutes in the oven, just because I like it a little bit crispy on the outside, just till it was a little golden brown. But if you like it soft, you can actually just skip this this portion of the recipe, because it really is fully cooked after you steam it. So it's up to you whether you like the tempeh soft or you would like it to have a little bit of a golden edge to it. And while that was in the oven, I added the can of fire-roasted tomatoes to the wok with the mushrooms. Then I added the cherry tomatoes and the white wine and the red pepper flakes, and I cooked that down for a little bit. The herbs I used were, I used 3 sprigs of thyme, 2 small sprigs of rosemary, 6 sage leaves, and 1/4 cup of fresh basil, and 2 tablespoons of fresh oregano. And like I said, if you don't have the fresh herbs, you can use dried herbs, just to use a little bit less, and, you know, adjust it according to your taste. And I cooked that at a high heat just for a few minutes to allow some of the liquid to evaporate and to meld some of those flavors together. Then I added the olives and the capers. I seasoned it with salt and pepper to taste. I removed the twigs of the thyme and the rosemary, because I now have gotten most of the flavor I wanted out of them, and I don't want the leaves come off of the thyme, but you're left with little twigs in there, so you just want to pull those out. Then I added the chopped parsley, cooked for just a few more minutes, reserving a little bit of parsley for garnish on the top. Then when it was all finished, I spooned the sauce, the tomato and caper sauce, on top of the tempeh on a platter, and served it with my favorite grain. You can serve it with rice or quinoa or pasta, whatever you like. And it's really delicious and is a beautiful meal. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Mary Mattingly. She is, as I said, a visual artist living and working in New York City. Most of her art is centered on the environment, food, and water-related issues, and that is why I connect so much with her. One of her most recent projects, and one of the reasons I invited her on, was her project called Swale, which is a floating food forest in New York. This year it was docked at the Brooklyn Army Terminal. And Swale is dedicated to rethinking and challenging New York City's connection to our environment. and it's built on a 130-foot by 40-foot floating platform, a big, huge barge, 5,000 square feet of growing space, and it's an edible forest garden. It's open to the public, and it functions both as a sculptural project and also as a tool for people to harvest free, delicious, healthy food. And it just, you know, it's the perfect intersection of public art and service. And Mary grew up in an agricultural town where the drinking water was polluted, and that informed and framed her understanding of water as a precious resource that needed to be protected. And Swale came out of a need to connect New York's waterways and public land in order to better care for it, and by proximity, each other. Swale is a tool to advocate for policy change, because not everyone in New York City has access to healthy food. And I am so happy to introduce all of you to Mary. Mary, are you with me?
Yeah. Hi, Bhavani. Thanks so much.
You're so welcome. Well, the last time I saw you, you were heading off to St. Petersburg for a show. How did that go? And what were you exhibiting there?
Yeah, that was great. I collaborated with an artist over there who works with food systems as well, mainly hydroponics, and we built a temporary public artwork in a park in St. Petersburg. It was a lot of fun. It was very quick.
Very quick, and you're coming back from somewhere now as well. Where are you coming back from now?
I was just in Minneapolis. I was teaching, I teach a program at the University of Hartford. That's a MFA Low program. So every semester we meet, since people are coming from everywhere, we meet in a different city, and we meet and figure out what people are doing locally around art, social practice, food justice. And in this case, we were able to talk with a lot of Native American groups who are working in different spaces there. It was pretty terrific.
Wonderful. So let's talk about Swale, this wonderful art project where I got to meet you and visit. It was harbored at the Brooklyn Army Terminal. And it is a floating food forest. And what inspired you to create Swale, and what is Swale's mission?
Well, I think it was inspired for personal reasons, but also for public reasons. And I think the more important public reason is when I learned that it was illegal to forage or pick anything in public from public space in New York City. And that's an old law that... that was put into place because the city was worried about people over foraging. So now it's considered destruction of property to take anything from public space, which in some regards makes a lot of sense. In others, at this time in our history in New York City, it's we're really looking for access to more spaces and for additional uses for public space. So Swale was is on the water specifically for that reason, because the rules on the water are different from the rules on land in public. So there's a common law that exists on New York City waterways that allows you to do certain things that you couldn't do in public space. So it was a way to circumvent that land law and allow space for people to come and pick fresh food for free, and also allow a space for city officials to see how this could work if it was implemented in New York City public parks, for example. So one of the things that I like to say, a statistic that I like to quote, is that there are actually 30,000 acres of public parkland right in New York City, compared to about 100 acres of community garden space. And community garden space is different just because not everyone can go and pick from those spaces. It's really, you know, demands that in your neighborhood you have access to a community garden space. So this would, if it works, would allow for a lot more space in the city to actually be growing healthy food and allow for a lot more access to people who, all of us, frankly, in the city need more access to public, to healthy food. Even in the supermarkets, there isn't much access. And unless you're extremely wealthy and you can shop at a few places that actually have decent produce, then you're really not getting the nutrients that you need.
Mm-hmm. So when did you first start Swale Project?
So it started in 2016, and started in Concrete Plant Park in the Bronx, in the South Bronx, which is a place that I had built relationships with community groups there through a past project called Water Pod. And so Swale was able to launch from Concrete Plant Park in the summer of 2016 and sort of took off from there and went to different public piers around the city.
Mm-hmm. But this year you didn't really move around so much, or did you? Or were you more stationary at the Brooklyn Army Terminal?
Well, Swale has been looking for a long-term home, and we started the first 2 years moving to different piers to build momentum for what we're calling public food, and it looks like we found a permanent home at the Brooklyn Army Terminal, which we're really excited about, and we Swale actually just moved to Peekskill, New York, for some repairs in order to be more long-term at the Brooklyn Army Terminal. There were some changes that needed to be made structurally. So, yeah, it was only there this year, and hopefully for the next coming years, it'll be at the Army Terminal more permanently.
Mm. Excellent. And when I was reading about it, it sounded like there were also some land-based projects that Swale participated in on Governor's Island and such. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, so this summer we weren't sure if we were going to have basically funding to continue the project. So we were imagining transitioning all of the plants from the barge to land on Governor's Island called the Loop. So that's in the southeast or the middle eastern part of Governor's Island, where there are some other groups like Earth Matter, who makes compost and grow NYC, and Ag Tech. So all these agricultural groups work in this area called the Loop, and Swale was invited to have a food forest growing on land there. And we are now working on both spaces. So now that the barge is able to stay, we're going to be there and on Governor's Island.
That's so exciting. In addition to growing vegetables, well, first, can you tell us what kind of vegetables you grew? Was everything on the barge perennial, or did you also have annual plants?
There are some self-seeding annual plants, like kales, some tomatillos, and even tomatoes ended up being self-seeding. Some things that were planted by guests the first year as annuals ended up coming back. But for the most part, it's entirely perennial, so a lot of medicinals, like echinacea or anise hyssop, but there are herbs like oregano, mints, and then lots of fruits like blackberry, blueberry, strawberry, grapes, and things that will continue to come back, yeah.
So amazing. And you even have trees on the barge. Is it the soil actually deep enough to support trees?
Yeah, there is an area that's on the barge that has a hill, and on that hill we have 8 apple trees. Off to the side of the hill, in an area with not as much soil, we have a peach tree and a persimmon and a cherry tree, and those are doing fairly well. I think we need to build up the soil in those areas, but we do have about 6 feet of soil on the hill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. You know, it's so amazing to see some of the earlier photos when you look online at the Swale Project, and then you look at what it looked like when I went to visit it, two
yeah.
totally different spaces. One, you know, all these little, very contained, organized plants where you can see the borders of each one. And when I was there at the end of the summer, everything was blended together. It was just so, not badly overgrown, but it was just so full and vibrant and green. It was just amazing to see the transformation.
Yeah, you know, I like to say that Swale's been a labor of love, and we started with a small volunteer group and nurseries who were donating plants, and we made some raised beds on a barge and really didn't know how long it would last, if at all, and then were able to come back the following year because we received the sponsorship from a cider company who actually, that's why we have those apple trees and we're able to landscape Swale. And then I think it became such a feature and people were into going there not only to pick food, but also to just relax and to be in a space that's so different from its surroundings. So that's, I think, one of the main reasons why it's been embraced, and now why it'll be more permanently at the Army Terminal, is because it really, now it's so uncanny and odd. You walk onto this barge and it's moving, but it looks like you're on a land, you're on land. So it's a very different experience and effect than the first year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when I was on it, you know, it's just odd. The fact that you feel the ground moving under your feet, but at the same time you're stationary on the land. So it was a unique experience. So what has the response been in general from both the public and the public, you know, people, and also city officials? What kind of response have you been getting?
So when we started, we wanted to really coalition build around public food. So we would ask everyone who came on to sign a document that would later be a petition for the city. And when we got through the first year, before we had even submitted that document to the city, the Parks Department came out to see Swale, and they saw the momentum that was building in this particular area where we were first docked in Concrete Plant Park, and they saw how much energy there was around it, that they actually decided to do a pilot project right in that park where anyone can go there and pick fresh food 24 hours a day. It's the only place in the city that's like that. And I think when people come on, there is an excitement, and it's visual and experiential, but it's also an excitement about doing something that we're not really allowed to do anywhere else in public in the city. So it's kind of, I'd say for the most part, it's been either people have been a little bit shy or afraid to take something, or it's been the opposite, where people are really eager and will bring bags and will collect things and come back repeatedly.
Right. Well, I know when you, when you created Swale, you have the option of, or you had to bring the soil on, so you had the option of choosing good organic soil, and you knew where it came from. A place like Concrete Park, I mean, of course, the name of it doesn't sound so appealing. Do they bring in soil before planting vegetables there, or are they using, soil that has been around and could possibly be toxic?
So that's definitely a concern, and that's one reason why there are a few reasons we learned why the law is sort of still in place. And one of them is that, depending on when the park was built, there could be problems with the soil and toxicity. Also that because budgets have been cut for parks, a lot of New York City parks are being maintained with chemicals. So a lot of herbicides are being used in certain parks. And then, like I said, the fear of the park completely changing the way the park looks or what's available in the park by it being overpicked. So in Concrete Plant Park, they did bring in soil. I think at first they thought it was because the park is fairly new, and they had remediated 6 feet of the soil initially before the park was even open. They thought that would be enough, but then at the end of the day, they ended up also building raised beds and bringing in more soil to grow those plants.
Good.
And they're really looking at it as
that.
A test space.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I was just saying that they are really looking at it as a test space, and if it goes well, they may do more, but right now they're not yet committed to the idea of doing this in other parks.
Mm-hmm. Right. And during the season, when visitors are coming onto the barge, are you also having workshops and teaching classes? I know when I was there briefly, you were having a little bit of a tincture class. People were using herbs and making some tinctures with that. Can you talk a little bit about the different classes you were offering?
Yeah, I mean, we've offered a different range of classes depending on who we meet, who comes onto Swale and is interested in doing something, then we'll arrange to do a course with them. And so we've done things like water filtration to making your own facial toner from plants to, doing tours for weeds, like plants that are considered weeds, so medicinal plants on Swale, but also off. So sometimes around the neighborhood that Swale is docked in, people will do walking tours. People have done a range of things from psychic wellness to plant dye labs and even seed sculptures and things like that. So making your own seed balls and making those into sculptures and then sort of growing those into areas where you want wildflowers to grow has been pretty popular.
Yeah,
we've done panels, lots of things. Always looking for new things.
Great. And so now you're doing programming on and off the barge. So now you're doing it in Governor's Island as well?
Yeah, so now we have these two sites. So we've been programming within a house on Governor's Island in Nolan Park, an historic house, and been doing this ongoing project there where we're asking people to help us to co-design the food forest in the loop through making a design in the house, basically, and then things like making sun prints, learning about preservation of foods and canning and things like that there at the house.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to continue through October. We'll be doing things there.
Oh, good. And you said swales went up to Peekskill for the winter? What kind of refurbishing has to happen to make it, to winterize it or to make it a year-round project?
Well, there's some deck work that's going to be done, and then a greenhouse is going to be put onto it. So that'll be a permanent kind of winterized space, so we can actually do programming in the winter on the barge as well. And that's another not a drawback about Governor's Island, but that's part of the what we're working through with Governor's Island is that that's only a space that can be open during the summer months as well. So it's really nice to be able to do winter programming. So that's one of our main things that we're restructuring.
Good. We're going to take a couple of minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about some of your other artwork and some of the projects you have coming up in the future. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Mary Mattingly, artist and founder of the art project Swale. Be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm talking with my guest today, Mary Mattingly, from the Project Swale, a New York City artist who has created a food forest right here in New York Harbor. And so, Mary, right before the break, I wanted to ask you about some of the other art projects you have going on. I mean, you've done so many art projects, and I love, you know, your theme is always seems to be around food, water, environment. You know, you touched on your project called Water Pod, You also had one called Flock House and Wetlands. Maybe you could talk a little bit about those and your inspiration behind doing projects that raise awareness about our environment.
With public artwork is to address what could be a commons. Believe that water is a commons and that food should be as well. And I think that doing these projects in public space is about building momentum for more commons, essentially. So projects like the Water Pod and Wetland were very similar. They were also on the water, and they Water Pod was a completely self-sufficient living system where five people lived for 6 months, and it went to different piers around the five boroughs, and we had chickens, gardens, annual gardens, cabins, and lots of appropriate technologies that had been modeled by someone from Humboldt State University, an engineer named Lonnie Grafman. And basically, it was a living experiment, and we had public events as well, but we were really eager to see if some of these things could be adopted by New York City and how well they really worked and how much time we would have to spend working our day jobs versus providing for ourselves if all of these living systems were in place and working fairly well. So that was an experiment, and it was put together without any money. It was put together by people donating things around the city. So businesses donating the use of the barge to solar panels, to IBC totes that we used for rainwater collection and things like that. And the city giving us 6 months to be in at public piers. Projects that I've done have almost always been collaborative, and I facilitate and sometimes take part, like in the Water Pod. I did live on the Water Pod for 6 months. They're really about action and the environment and climate change, absolutely. Thinking about food security, resiliency, and ecosystem health, and how you could illustrate those and make stories out of those in public.
Mm-hmm. I did see your piece up at Storm King this summer. You want to talk about the palm forest?
Yeah, so that's definitely about storytelling. So there are three palms that were able to be brought from Florida and transplanted. They were grown, never planted in the ground in Florida, but grown in containers and then transplanted up in Storm King, where the prediction is that we'll have 4 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer seasons in 2100. So it was looking at migration, plant migration, in from now and through 2100 and potentials and what might have to happen and what might naturally happen. So I guess I mean what might humans want to transplant to certain places when it gets more and more difficult to grow apple trees in upstate New York, for example, with less and less freezing days, and then what potentially the land might look like, how we might need to function, how that's a story about resiliency and potentially regeneration. And it really came out of working in Alaska and learning the nuances around how fast climate change is really showing there and how much it's changing people's ways of life, and then how coming there to visit as an outsider and from a perspective of thinking the Arctic should always be frozen, how surprised I was to hear people almost, you know, hear people dealing with the fact that it won't be, and that to make the best of it, people are starting to plant things, and they're starting to do things like make food forests in Arctic tundra. So I was really thinking about resiliency and what that could look like in New York State.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, before you know it, we'll be growing palm trees, you know, growing right in New York, growing bananas and, you know, mangoes.
Yeah, I mean, we will likely have the conditions to do that. I doubt they will naturally migrate that far, but if we decide to plant them, then they will have an easier time surviving then than they do now.
Absolutely. So what other projects do you have in the works right now?
I've been working on something with the Mystic Seaport Museum in Connecticut about the ocean as a commons and reconfiguring their collection and telling a story about the positive and what a commons could be. So looking at people like Eleanor Ostrom, who have studied commons on land and how that can work when people know each other and trust each other, and then how thinking about the entire ocean as a commons, and especially those places considered the high seas, how difficult it is to see them, how difficult it is to get there, and how that limits the use of the commons and often makes it a place where things are being dumped, where lots of tragedies are happening. And so that's a research project that I've been working on. I've also been working on the food forest on Governor's Island and some photography as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you hear about the high seas and the rules or laws that don't exist in the open waters and, common days, or modern day slavery that's taking place on fishing ships, and and there's no way for people to really control it because they're out there without anyone enforcing any rules. So
right, yeah, and there are what's called flags of convenience, where an organization or corporation can register a ship in any country in the world. So we'll most often go to countries with the least amount of oversight, and then can operate with those within those countries' rules, which may be none. So that's also why that's resulting, I think, in the modern slavery and neocolonialism, and how much is being robbed from the ocean, essentially, and it's just because there is not a governing set of rules.
Yeah, it's really scary. And, I know I touched on it before when I was saying what was the response from the public in relation to SWALE. But in general, working in this arena, what have you noticed any difference in concern within the public sphere of our food system, and or more awareness about the problems surrounding our food system, and more desire for people to become more engaged?
Yeah. I think that there is a lot of action happening around our food systems, and for great reasons. I think from the packaging that we receive food in to where that usually garbage is going, and I think that having fresh kills closed, and then having, I think, at least New York City, and I'm not sure about the state as a whole, but New York City's garbage is going to at least 8 other states. People are thinking about it absolutely for health reasons. One of the main reasons that I wanted to undertake SWALE was when I found out that I had celiac, and that's become so, such a modern story. So many people are having different ailments from foods that we eat. And then realizing that, really a lot of that has to do with what we're eating. When we were docked in the Bronx at Concrete Plant Park, almost every other person who came onto SWALE had some sort of food issue, and it was really remarkably scary to see how widespread of an issue it is and how many people are affected, and the conditions that different people are living in is a food justice story. It's really important that different areas in New York City have better access to fresh food, and it's an entire, it's an entire country story. It's like it's what we're saying about the high seas, and it's that, food is being grown sometimes in the United States, is being shipped to another country to be packaged, it's coming back. It's just tremendous amount of waste along the way, and I think people are more and more aware of that and want to see changes.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about, how many people have some sort of food issue or food allergy. I know I've been cooking for 40 years, and I can really see the difference from, I used to cook for people that you know, maybe we're choosing a vegetarian diet over a non-vegetarian diet. But, you know, celiac didn't exist. You know, my kids brought peanut butter all the time to school. You know, it was a great vegetarian meal. You know, there weren't peanut-free tables. And then, you know, back 40 years ago, you know, it was just the beginning of the experimenting with genetically modified things. And when they say, you know, there's been no real testing for it to see if it's proof, I like to say step back and look at our whole food system as one big experiment, you know, at all the manipulating that they've done with our food and the fact that everyone now does have food allergies, and whether it's from the pesticides, the herbicides, or treating the wheat with Roundup when it's harvested so that it dries quicker, you know. Who says, you know, maybe the celiac isn't really the wheat? Maybe it's the Roundup that's on the wheat, you know. So there's so many questions when you, really start dissecting what has changed in our food system that could be causing these. It's just not a simple answer. And that's why, you know, I guess from doing it for so long for me, I just really try to not be judgmental and tell everyone they have to find the diet that works for them, but start with real food. You know, find out where you're starting from, where it's being sourced from, because that, I think, is the culprit.
Yeah, and I think really, that foraging is a great option too, because there are these plants that we have access to and that we're eating are cultivated in a different way, and they're cultivated to be sweeter, to taste a little bit differently, but then they also lose a lot of nutrients along that cultivation. And I think it is important to kind of find a safe place in the wild where you can harvest from and get some of those nutrients that aren't really available in most of the plants that are being grown and harvested. And I can also say, just from my own experience, that celiac is supposed to be hereditary, but nobody else in my family has it. And I spent about 10 years of my life eating really terrible food, and I'm pretty sure it's from that. You know, the cheapest food that I could find, which was what I could afford, and most of it was breads. I was also vegetarian, so I was mostly eating breads, and now I can't anymore. And I think that, you know, it's probably just what you're saying. It's like eating the wrong foods for so long gives you more problems. So I think, yeah, it's complicated.
Right. Well, I remember, for me, the wake-up call was, maybe 6 years ago when I was at Terra Madre in Italy, and they were talking about wheat and how most semolina wheat was grown down in Sicily because of the climate, and that, you know, any wheat that was grown was south of Rome. And they were the biggest producers of wheat. And then, all of a sudden, Canada became the biggest producers of wheat. And, the Italians are, like, scratching their heads going, how can they be growing wheat in Canada with the wrong climate? And then they found out that they were spraying it with Roundup to dry it quicker. And it's the drying process that was an issue with the climate. And so all of a sudden, it's like, Eureka.
Really scary.
You know? So, you know, we're just one big guinea pig to our government and corporations who are playing with our food system. And so we need to all take it back. And I just want to thank you so much for the work you're doing, because you're really bringing it right to the people, to people really questioning it and making it alive and making it experiential and, you know, taking it out of the head and putting it right into the heart, you know, and it's perfect. So needed. So thanks for that great work.
Thank you.
Any openings coming up or anything that you want to share with my listeners? Where can we find you in New York showing?
Yeah, you know, I have some artwork at Brick, which is downtown Brooklyn, and it's looking at a supply chain for a particular military truck, but it's connecting it with the making of this one product with, how it's made all over the world, essentially where the minerals are being mined from to where it's being manufactured. And that's up in, through November 13th at a place called Brick, BRIC. And, Governor's Island Food Forest will open in the spring. So please come out to that.
Great. And when does Swale return to the Brooklyn Army Terminal?
It looks like it will be about April 15th.
April 15th. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, Mary, thank you so much for coming and joining with us today. It's been wonderful, and I love your project, and I love the Storm King project, and the work you're doing is just so needed. So keep it up. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
You're welcome. And everyone for listening, thank you so much for joining us. I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.